people are seriously questioning how long it'll take for Taliban to surround and strangle Kabul.
More Taliban takeovers, this one with a difference. It's Friday, August 13th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Also ahead, the state of talks with the Taliban. Changes in COVID vaccine plans. Hawaii uses history to deal with climate change. Jubilation from the U.S. Hmong community. And a virtual Van Gogh exhibit. It is all on today's VOA Asia. Taliban insurgents Thursday captured Afghanistan's strategically important southeastern city of Ghazni without much of a fight. Aisha Tanzim is VOA's Afghanistan and Pakistan bureau chief. She joins us from Kabul. Aisha, what happened in Ghazni?
Well, first of all, Ghazni is very strategic. It's on Kabul-Kandahar highway, for once, and it's a large city, fairly large, and it's very diverse. What happened was that the governor of Ghazni, Taliban actually, he surrendered to Taliban, and Taliban drove him in their cars to the next province, to the government-controlled area. Later, the government arrested him. So there are reports, and it seems like, from the optics of it, that he did make some kind of deal with the Taliban for safe passage. So that is why the fall of Ghazni is so different from other provinces, because while in some other district centers and some areas we did see, you know, security forces abandoning posts, etc., we did not see the top official of a province surrendering to Taliban like this.
What does this do to whatever defense Kabul might have, Ghazni being so close to the capital city?
So all of this, you know, Ghazni being so close to capital city, Ghazni falling. Now there are credible reports that Herat may also have fallen. VOA's Afghan services reporter confirmed the Taliban claim that they've reached the police headquarters. So if it hasn't fallen, they've at least reached inside the city, which would give almost the entire north to them. This does not bode well for Kabul. Kabul is getting squeezed from both sides, from the north and from the south. And people are seriously questioning how long it'll take for Taliban to surround and strangle Kabul.
Overall, how are the people with whom you speak in Kabul feel about what's going on?
There's a lot of apprehension. There's a lot of fear. There's a lot of... Everybody that I know, rich, poor, middle class, they're all trying to flee Afghanistan. Those who can afford it have applied for visas and are trying to go to other countries that way. Other people who can't afford it, are some of them are trying to go illegally out of the country. Everybody is looking for a way out. I talked to internally displaced people today who had fled fighting from other provinces, and they said they saw their futures very dark. They did not see any hope or where they could go next if fighting came to Kabul. So yes, people are not feeling good about what's happening in the country.
Is there blame to go around, at least with what these people are talking about?
Yes, there's lots of blame going around. People are criticizing the Ghani administration. People are criticizing neighboring Pakistan. When you talk to journalists and officials, they're speculating that even Iran and some other regional countries may be helping the Taliban a little bit, maybe to hedge their bets, maybe to make sure that when the Taliban come to power, their borders are protected. So there's a lot of blame going around.
What are they thinking about the United States?
People are not happy that the United States left the way it left. Everybody thinks the U.S. left too quickly, that the presence of 3,500 U.S. forces and a couple of billion dollars a year was sustainable. The U.S. could have done it longer. The biggest complaint is this. They say that when U.S. negotiated a deal with the Taliban, they kept the Afghans on the sidelines. The Afghans were not part of that deal. But at the same time, officials complain, the U.S. bound their hands They were not allowed to attack the Afghans for the entire year when they made the deal and before the intra-Afghan negotiations started and before the U.S. announced a withdrawal.
Aisha Tanzim is BOA's Afghanistan and Pakistan Bureau Chief, and she joins us from Kabul. Thanks once again. These are some of the stories you'll find at BOANews.com. Ship sailing under Panama flag runs aground in northern Japan, leaking oil. Indonesia to investigate forcible restraint of a Nigerian diplomat. New Zealand's Prime Minister says the nation will not open its borders to non-residents until next year to preserve the success they have had against the coronavirus pandemic. Sri Lanka files charges against 25 Easter bombing suspects. Vietnam concerned over vaccine supply as COVID-19 cases near a record. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia, Instagram, Twitter, and on the VOANews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Ira Melman. Delegations from the Taliban, Afghanistan, and Pakistan met this week in Doha. Shah Mahmood Qureshi, Pakistan's foreign minister, said his government still was advocating for peace. Jason Campbell is a policy researcher with the RAND Corporation. He discussed how to reconcile the statements made by all parties at the meeting with the events on the ground in Afghanistan. He spoke with International Edition Steve Miller.
So Jason, where I wanted to begin our conversation is here. If we look at the comments that are coming out of Doha for this extended Troika talk, Pakistan, the Taliban, and the Afghan delegation all say that they're committed to the peace process. But both sides have also said that the Taliban will not recognize a government with Ashraf Ghani in it. The Afghanistan government says that Ashraf Ghani is the duly elected president, so any new government needs to be included with him until the end of his term. What do you make out of the comments and the process that's taking place in Doha?
Sure. Well, I think just at the outset, it's important to point out that, you know, you're always going to have every side stating that they're committed to a peace process or that they support peace. And that may be accurate, but the bigger question is always, you know, under what terms? And that's where I think you find a pretty considerable divergence. And I think that's what we're seeing here coming out of Doha. The issue is that as of yet, the Taliban have not articulated really in any way a clear political vision for Afghanistan. You know, there have been periodically some statements that are a little bit more pragmatic, that they, you know, state that, you know, they want to be part or they're willing to be part of a more inclusive governing system that doesn't necessarily have them in the dominant position. But they haven't gone really beyond that in many ways. So the stakeholders here are left sort of continually trying to reassess what it is the Taliban want. Particularly given that what we're seeing on the ground in Afghanistan is increasingly divergent from some of the statements that are made in Doha. On the Afghanistan government side, I think that is, again, sort of the expected soundbite is that they are remain committed to the duly elected president and that he should finish out his term. But I think in reality, all sides here understand that, you know, getting to some sort of a stable political outcome in Afghanistan is not simply a matter of incorporating the Taliban into the current governing structure.
So moving forward, Jason, taking a look, as you mentioned, the situation on the ground, from a policy standpoint and from, you know, a practicality standpoint, what do you see moving forward?
What is going to interest me in the days and weeks ahead is going to be the degree to which the Taliban, one, continue to kind of press their current advantage in and around other provincial capitals, and two, the degree to which they become sort of hunkered down in those provincial capitals that they've recently taken. What we've seen periodically, and not just in recent months, but over the years, is that the Taliban will go in and you know, take over a city center, a provincial center, a district center. They will, you know, chase out the Afghan security forces. They will raise their flag and they will, you know, film it, take pictures and kind of reap the propaganda victory. And then in a few weeks, or days or weeks, they will be, sort of again, relinquish that, that territory, usually in the face of a response by the Afghan security forces. But the damage is already done because they've been able to, again, bolster their narrative that the momentum is on their side and they're going to inevitably take over. I think longer term or in the medium term, I think the Taliban has to be wary of taking over too much ownership of territory, because in so doing, they kind of in a de facto become the local governance structure. And I think that the Taliban have proven to be fairly a poor governing entities in the past, and are not perhaps as unified as they appear to be when it comes to how best to again actually manage and govern some of these local areas.
Jason Campbell, a policy researcher with the RAND Corporation, speaking with VOA's Steve Miller. You're listening to VOA Asia. Happening now in Asia, a Philippine court dismisses a libel case against Maria Ressa, one of several lawsuits filed against a journalist who says she's been targeted because of her news site's critical reports on President Rodrigo Duterte. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We do appreciate your attendance to VOA Asia today. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration was expected to authorize a third shot of a COVID-19 vaccine for some people with weakened immune systems. An advisory panel of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention will meet Friday to discuss giving booster shots of COVID-19 vaccines for some people with compromised immune systems. Scientists have been debating whether to offer extra doses of COVID-19 vaccines to certain immunocompromised people, such as organ transplant recipients or cancer patients. A recent study by Johns Hopkins University found that many transplant patients had little or no antibody protections after receiving the full two doses of a vaccine, but a third shot did boost their antibody protections. In a related development, the CDC is recommending that all pregnant women receive a COVID-19 vaccine. The agency issued the advice Wednesday after releasing data that showed women faced no increased risk of miscarriage after receiving at least one dose of a vaccine. Many U.S. hospitals, mostly in the southern part of the country, are struggling to keep up with the huge surge in COVID-19 patients fueled by low vaccination rates and the more infectious Delta variant. Reuters' Gloria Tso reports on the situation in the state of Louisiana.
As the American South grapples with a dangerous new wave of COVID-19, the rapid spread of the Delta variant has unsettled both doctors and patients. With some of the lowest vaccination rates in the country, Louisiana is one of the hardest hit states, hitting a record high of COVID hospitalizations last week. At Ochsner Medical Center in New Orleans, doctors say they've had to reserve more than 5 units just for COVID patients. Jerome Batiste is one of them.
I just thought my immune system is too good. And, you know, I barely get sick, so I wouldn't say I was invincible, but you know, I just figured it's been all this time and I pray and I keep everything clean and sanitized. I thought I would be good.
Nationwide, COVID-19 cases have averaged 100,000 for 3 days in a row, up 35% over the past week, according to a Reuters tally. Along with Florida and Arkansas, Louisiana has reported the most new cases in the past week based on population. Dr. Catherine Baumgarten says that's largely due to low vaccination rates.
But if you look at our rate of increase of cases, it's a straight line up. Whereas the rest of the United States has had this curve of cases up, and their curve is much lower than our straight line up of cases. It's because we're not vaccinated.
Delta's surge has renewed debate over mask wearing and vaccine mandates. Louisiana State University recently said unvaccinated students would have to provide monthly proof of a negative coronavirus test. At one local pharmacy, that news prompted a rush of college students to sign up for the shot.
That was Gloria Tso reporting. Australia's capital city, Canberra, is going into a snap one-week lockdown from Thursday evening after reporting its first locally acquired case of COVID-19 in more than a year. Flora Bradley Watson has more.
There was panic buying at the supermarkets in Australia's capital, Canberra, on Thursday, after it was announced that the city would go into a snap week-long lockdown. Canberra has reported its first locally acquired case of COVID-19 in more than a year. Authorities said the new measures were needed because they were unsure how the man in his 20s acquired the virus. Chief Minister of the Capital Territory, Andrew Barr.
We do not currently know the source of the infection, but extensive investigation has been underway for many hours. This is the most serious public health risk that we have faced in the Territory this year, really since the beginning of the pandemic.
Australia's two largest cities, Sydney and Melbourne, are already in hard lockdowns as the country tries to get on top of the fast-spreading Delta variant. The government has announced it may deploy extra military personnel in Sydney to ensure compliance with the rules. Despite 7 weeks of lockdown, daily infections there continue to hover near record highs. New South Wales on Thursday reported 345 new locally acquired cases, up from 344 a day earlier. In neighbouring Victoria, 20 new cases were reported, and residents in Melbourne were preparing to enter their second week of lockdown. Experts see Australia heading into a cycle of stop-and-start lockdowns until a higher vaccination coverage is reached.
Reuters' Flora Bradley Watson reporting.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see with links to easily find them. VOA Asia Twitter, we're always online for you.
This news from VOA Asia, an Indian rocket carrying a powerful Earth observation satellite failed to fire fully Thursday. The state-run space agency said that a setback for the country's space program. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Hawaiians are turning to traditional practices for insights on coping with climate change. As Michael Sullivan reports from Honolulu, they're seeking inspiration from the past to achieve sustainability in the future.
Rising ocean waters are causing erosion, threatening coastal Hawaiian homes. Oahu, the state's principal island, could lose 40% of its beaches from erosion by 2050, says one study. Harming tourism, the largest source of income for the islands. Another problem, higher temperatures are causing erratic precipitation and, in places, drought.
Some rainfall is on average going up over time, some is going down. In Hawaii, we've actually seen drying out.
With less stable weather, the islands are seeing more severe storms and flooding, as in Maui in March. There are other impacts, too.
Groundwater wells near the coast, agriculture, infrastructure.
A modern urban center, Honolulu has paved over waterways to control flooding, blocking natural watersheds that once linked the mountains, wetlands, and coast in a single ecosystem. Native Hawaiians called it Ahupua'a.
And we're standing in front of an Ahupua'a. And the Ahupua'a was the Native Hawaiian system of managing resources from ridge to reef.
Hawaii now imports most of its food, But there are efforts to renew traditional farming and conservation methods, including here on the eastern or windward shore of Oahu. Nick Rapoon works for a nonprofit group that grows traditional staple foods like taro and is restoring this lowland area to its natural state. Other groups are restoring the mountain watershed and an aquaculture pond where native Hawaiians once raised fish.
We're just trying to do what we know has been done and what we know worked before. We're not reinventing the wheel with these systems. We're just trying to, revive them.
Alapaki Luke, who teaches Hawaiian language and culture, says taro patches trap silt and control erosion, something native Hawaiians understood. That traditional wisdom is important, he says.
I'm not about going back 400 or 500 years ago, but we can use the foundation, which you call a kahua, of the Ike, the native tradition, in a modern setting.
Luke says the traditional practices that once supported a population of hundreds of thousands on these islands still have much to teach us. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Honolulu.
Making headlines in Asia, officers from the U.S. and Taiwanese Coast Guards have met to discuss improving cooperation and communication despite efforts by China to isolate the self-governing island democracy. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, Sunisa Lee's Olympic gold in gymnastics highlighted the Hmong community in the U.S., an often overlooked refugee group from Southeast Asia. Lee embodies Hmong pride as VOA's Busawan Samala and Maximud Muscati report from her homecoming parade.
The pride is palpable in St. Paul's small community of East Side Hmong for one of their own, 18-year-old Sunisa Lee, who triumphed in Tokyo in the all-around gymnastics competition.
She's our Hmong Mulan. She brought honor to us all, so we are extremely, extremely proud of her.
A staffer at the Midwest Gymnastics Center in Little Canada, Minnesota, where Lee trained, estimated it cost around $100,000 to raise an Olympian. The payoff is a full scholarship to Auburn University.
Nobody expects her to go to the Olympics. Okay. But I think people, not only do they see the potential, but I think because I believe in her, my wife believes in her, and our friends, they believe in us.
The Hmong originated in mountainous regions of Vietnam, Laos, and Thailand. Those who resettled in the U.S. after the Vietnam War came from Laos, and they arrived with few possessions. But they had a cultural tradition of helping each other.
The east side of St. Paul is a win to the Hmong community. It means a lot beyond words can describe. I'm just so thrilled, so proud of her, no words can describe.
This is Noprat Chaisila Mongkun for VOA News.
We continue on VOA Asia. Known for his extraordinary eye-catching, colorful images, Vincent van Gogh is one of the world's most famous 19th century painters. Now, large-scale copies of his artwork can be viewed through digital technology at two exhibits traveling around the world. VOA's Deborah Block takes us to one of them in Washington.
Van Gogh, the immersive experience, wows visitors in 360 degrees, displaying and moving images using cutting-edge 3D video mapping technology. Mario Iacampo is the president and creative director for the exhibition.
We take the art, we digitally remaster it, and then we animate the individual elements within the art, but always respecting the content of the art and never really introducing new things to the art.
Visitor Christina McGee finds it exhilarating to listen to the music while the images flow into each other.
What was really different was it was on the floor, too, so it was really like you were inside the painting.
Another visitor, Mike Tosto, is enjoying looking at Van Gogh's paintings in a new way.
You can really see the movement coming right out of, like, the lines and shapes.
Jacopo says the exhibition is a virtual museum that pays homage to Van Gogh, whose paintings were not displayed during his lifetime. Deborah Block, VOA News, Washington.
Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our service chief, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Jim Stevenson, Keith Lane, Amy Heibels, Chris Cascao, and Doug Bernard. I'm Ira Melman. Do your best to stay safe and enjoy the day ahead.